Thank you. That introduction's a lot better than I usually receive. Once I had to give a lecture at University of Mexico, and I arrived a little early, and I looked around the bull ring, and I saw somebody all dressed up. I said, "You're the matador," and he said, "No." I said, "You're the picador," and he said, "No." I said, "You're the bandillero," and he said, "No." I said, "What do you do around here?" He said, "I lift the gate up to let the bull through." So thank you, Mr. Wilkinson, for that introduction. My job this evening or this late afternoon will be to lecture, and your job will be to listen. And if you finish before I do, which some of you may have already done, raise your hands and I'll quit. Actually, Mr. Wilkinson didn't give you my qualifications. They really are threefold. One, I am a professor at the Baruch College of the City University of New York. He mentioned University of Wisconsin. I was a dean of the School of Business, which had the largest number of students in the United States. I was in control like 15,000 students, and I was there during the times when the students were making unconditional demands on the faculty, and one student had a bumper sticker on his car saying, "There is no gravity, the whole earth sucks." And so I was in that terrible period. Second, I am an industrial psychologist. I work with companies as broad as Crescent Oil in Britain and the Kellogg Company in Manchester and General Electric in the United States. Industrial psychology is much like the sex life of an elephant. It's practiced at very high levels amongst much noise and confusion. Third, I'm a consultant. A consultant knows eight ways to make love. He just doesn't know any girls. And so within that framework, I'm going to try to relate to you my experiences of what makes for key executives. And as Sigmund Freud said, it's not always easy to tell the truth, especially when one must be brief. And I have to point out in all humility that what I'm about to discuss with you is underscored by Plato in his book 4, when he says, "In all things God, and together with God, luck and timing pilots all human endeavors." And one must indeed concede that these are accompanied by yet a third thing, a gentler thing, which is artful skill. So I want to talk to you about that artful skill. I can't help God, and I can't help timing, and I can't help chance, because that happens to us all. But I want to talk to you about close to 2,000 executives that I have analyzed, both across this nation of Britain as well as in the United States, and give you some of the common characteristics. And I want to point out that these are constantly in a state of change. Never in the history of mankind have we gone through so many changes as I have observed. When I was in Britain during the Battle of the Bulge, or in Europe, General McAuliffe, by the way, I throw my students sugarless candy when they give me a bright answer. It's sugarless because my bright students were getting diabetes. Who is General McAuliffe? Any of you remember who General McAuliffe was? He was the American general at the Battle of the Bulge. And when the Germans said, "Surrender," he responded with nuts. Anyway, General McAuliffe had all the troops around, and he said, "We are now facing the greatest challenge facing any American army. They're completely surrounding us, which means we can attack in any direction." I also want to point out that I don't want to create any new enemies by this presentation. I'm reminded of King Arthur had all the knights. You're very big with knights here in England, with all your sirs. He had all the knights of the Round Table around him, and one night Lord Lochinvar came in all torn apart and disheveled, and he said, "Where hast thou been, O knight?" He said, "About this killing, destroying, raping your enemies in the east." He said, "I have no enemies in the east." He said, you got it now. One. Good are managers, executives I have known who have been very successful, learn how to manage fear. And when you're in the kind of challenges that you have here in your tech, with the steel industry, with changing over, with changing cultures, one needs individuals like your great Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, who said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Nameless, gnawing, paralyzing fear that numbs the will to turn defeat into victory. But I want to point out that some degree of fear is necessary to have maximum performance. Up the phylogenetic scale, those organisms that did not survive because they were too efficient and they got too comfortable. I believe that the Britain and the United States are going to face a massive threat from Germany. We've already faced that massive threat from Japan. Germans are well organized, disciplined, have massive training programs. I think your great Margaret Thatcher, I don't want to get into your politics, was absolutely right when she pointed out the anxiety that I guess John Major decided to play that down. But I believe that one needs to fear to keep awake. I fear everything. When I go to an airport, I want to know why they call it a terminal. I worry when the pilot says, I'm making my final approach. I worry about such things as whether Orthodox Jews can drink Ham's beer. Second, you need to differentiate, one, the management of fear. Second, you need to differentiate a manager from a leader. Let me see if I can give you the five differentiations. A manager administrates. A leader innovates. And by the way, I know I go too fast. It's one of my problems. So what I'd suggest is that you get more from reading than you do from lecturing, but I will be happy if you'll give me your cards to send you the backup articles that back up these comments. I read everything. I read everything from National Geographic to Playboy magazine, primarily because I like to see colored pictures of places I will never visit. The manager administrates. The leader innovates. The manager maintains. The leader develops. The manager relies on systems. The leader relies on people. Saul pointed that out in his first comments about human resources. The manager counts on controls. The leader counts on trust. The manager does things right. The leader does the right thing. And at your tech conference in Brighton, where I was honored to attend and lecture to, one of the speakers pointed out that managers need to remember that 5 years from now, honest and well-intentioned people will look back and say they were glad he did that. So second, we have to differentiate between managers and leaders. Third, you need to beware that the things that bring down great managers are certain negatives, what I call them unhealthy narcissism. Let me see if I could give you the characteristics of unhealthy narcissism. One, a grandiose sense of certainty, a feeling that they do not need feedback. They don't need learning or training or education. I would have put it a little differently than your great prime minister recently pointed out about the life of experience rather than formal education, which created this stir, especially among training and tech groups. And I can see why. I would put it that I believe that you should have a commitment to learning, but not a commitment to formal education. I think there's a formal commitment to education, not a commitment to formal education. Because executives need to keep learning because the world is moving so fast. Next, the feeling that there is a disdain for subordinates. They feel, if this guy is so smart, how can he work for me? Third, they lack humor, a sense of perspective. Next, they do not recognize that people need praise. Everybody needs a psychological stroke. Even as infants, if you do not hold infants, you cannot pay lip service to love. It has to be in the touch and the feel and the expression. I play a little golf. I play it poorly, but I was watching somebody in front of me checking their golf bags through on a plane, and I was going out to Arizona, and the man in front of me was very arrogant, and he was being very nasty to the porter. So I went up to the porter. I said, "You handle yourself very well." He said, "I'm nothing but a Christian gentleman." I said, "That's great." He said, "You see that guy? He's going to Miami with you. His bags tonight will be in Manchester, New Hampshire." So people eventually bring down arrogant people. Third, know the difference between leaders of 10, leaders of hundreds, leaders of thousands. And here I go back to the Old Testament. That's on the left as you go in. Just in case the vicar, I understand there's a vicar in the audience, doesn't know where, he knows where it is, but maybe some of the parishioners don't know. It's on the left as you go in, and Jethro, who is Jethro? By the way, who is Jethro? He was Moses' father-in-law. And he said to Moses, "Moses, you're not going to make it. You're trying to do too much yourself. Here's what I want you to do, Moses. I want you to go out and find able men. Some can lead 10, some can lead 100, some can lead 1,000. And know the difference, Moses, because if you don't know those differences, they will kill you." What is the difference between leaders of 10, leaders of 100, leaders of thousands? By the way, what church, worldwide church, organizes themselves into leaders of 10, leaders of hundreds, leaders of thousands? You know what church does that? There here in England as well, the Mormon church. Leaders organize themselves in leaders of 10, leaders of 100, leaders of thousands. And leaders of 10 are fundamentally platoon leaders. The loyalty is to them as a leader. Leaders of hundreds, the loyalty is to the organization. And leaders of thousands, the loyalty is to the cause. I had breakfast this morning with, I hate people who drop names, I recently said to the Queen. with your leaders, Brian Wilson, who just was knighted for his work with Ted Cruz. And he said, "What happens to me is unimportant." Of course, he would say that if he got knighted. He said, "What happens to the tech concept is what I'm concerned about." that this must not fall under whatever happens, whether it's labor or the conservatives who win, it's a tech concept that becomes almost as good. The leaders of thousands are leaders of causes. Next, the ability to understand that you don't have to have a lot of IQ to be a good manager. The world of business is run by C students. It doesn't help. It doesn't hurt. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, you see, the more IQ you have, sometimes you get so confused. Like Hamlet, you're sicklied over with the pale cast of thought. You develop the cynophobia. Say, on the one hand, on the other hand. Harry Truman, our former president, used to say, I wish I'd have one-armed economists. You know what an economist is. He's somebody who likes numbers. He doesn't have the personality to become an accountant. How much IQ? I have a 2x2 table that I use. High IQ, high drive. Make him a staff man. He doesn't have the capacity. He sees too many things. He's a great staff man. Henry Kissinger. I went to school with Henry. I knew Henry before he had an accent. I checked his grades, found he got an A in every subject except that he got a B in European history. Confident, but Margaret Thatcher. 2x2 table, high IQ, high drive, good staff man. I interviewed President Nixon. I said to him, by the way, President Nixon, you shouldn't have used Germans to do the bugging. Ehrlichman and Haldeman. Should you do Japanese? They're shorter. They're better electronically. Third, they would have confessed to the break-in at Warning Gate. And finally, they would have committed Harry Carey. You absolutely wouldn't have had this problem. I said to President Nixon, what was your description of Henry Kissinger? He said, Henry was marvelous, but like all intellectuals like you, he could not make a decision. He said, after we bombed Cambodia, he said, maybe we shouldn't have done that. He said, but Henry, I can't take the bombs back. High IQ, high IQ, low drive, doesn't want to do everything himself. He wants to delegate. Bush, I think, by the way, is much brighter than Reagan, in case you haven't noticed. Reagan had a lovely manner, but no one would accuse him of having an inordinate intellectual capacity. But Bush does. Bush is quite a bit of Kappa. He's the youngest, 17 years old or 18 years old. He's a pilot already. And high IQ, low drive, but you notice he spends a lot of time playing golf. He spends a lot of time on his boat. He doesn't want to do everything himself. That was the problem with Jimmy Carter, to use our expressions in the United States. He was too compulsive. So you can't be compulsive and be a good manager. You gotta know what to check. Every president shoots himself in the foot. Problem with Jimmy was he reloaded so fast. High IQ, low drive. Low IQ, low drive, good junior line officer. Low IQ, high drive, he'll kill you. My father would say, son, cities can change, but stupid is absolutely forever. Next, the capacity to have a kind of serenity. And by that I mean you do not take the criticisms of your performance seriously. Because nobody's going to be perfect in management jobs. You've got to make mistakes. And somebody said, I'd rather be 100% wrong than 90% nearly right. Because when you are wrong, what happens? If you plug in your VCR and it doesn't work, you go to the manual. And you learn something. If everything works, you never learn anything. That's the problem with affluence. You don't learn anything when you're too affluent. You learn only when you make errors. Out of that, you get your strengths. So serenity means that you can take criticism and not take it personally. I was speaking to some members of the House of Lords, and they said it was a problem with John Major. He's learning now to be less sensitive, but he was very sensitive in prison. I think that's true of any of the politicians. They have to learn. They get very thin skin. But in management, you also have to develop that kind of scar tissue, that kind of serenity, or a kind of tranquility, where you do not take all the criticism, but say, maybe I can learn something from it. Next and critical is one of the things that is not done well in the Western world is decent performance reviews. How many of you here have in your company's performance review program? Okay, a few of you. If you do interviews, if I've done, and people who have done performance reviews, you'll find that training, the manager, the performance review is almost non-existent. They just give them the form and say, go ahead and do it. Let me see if I can give you some guidelines on how to do better performance reviews in terms of the general principles. One, never start just with the praise. Rather give an overall picture. Say, there are some things in your performance with which I am delighted. There are some things in your performance, Mr. Watkins, which represent a challenge. You now have his attention. You see, because if you go to the dentist and he said, open up your mouth, and he puts a drill in, he said, this won't hurt you, and he puts a drill in and he hurts you, you go through the ceiling because you're not ready. At least now you're ready. I suggest the next time you go to the dentist, if it's a male dentist, grab him by the gonads and pull him closer and say, we're not going to hurt each other. Start with the negative. Remember you told him, you're giving him an overall view. So here are one or two of the things which you need to perform a little bit better in my judgment. Remember, nobody is perfect, and if I don't point this out to you, an indictment that nestles in the back of the prosecutor's head deprives you of your right of self-defense. There are one or two things with which I think we can do a little better. Start with the night. Second, never do it at night. Darkness and troubled minds make poor combinations. He or she goes home, and the spouse says, what happened today? He says, well, you know, that wretch said about me. She says, you know, he's right. You know, you've created a bloody mess. Never at night. Never on Friday, because then he'll ventilate all weekend. He'll never get over it. He'll kill Saturday and Sunday. He'll be ready to kill you or himself. Never on weekends. Never on Friday. Never at night. Also, remember, no more than one or two at a time. If he listens once or twice, he says, you know, that's an interesting point you're making about my performance. And you say, well, in addition, you know, wives and husbands do that too. And once they get one criticism across, and I dump the whole duffel. Is you a lousy to my mother? Or my brother? You know, just because he says, well, you may have a point. Then he or she will dump the load. I do a whole lecture on this conflict between job and family. Never at night. No more than one or two at a time. Start with the criticism. Don't do it on weekends. Also, offer some deadlines of timetables by which you will evaluate change.
anybody will agree to anything if you don't require a timetable. Oh, sure, I'll do that. See you next year. You need to put every recommendation on a timetable. You need to put every recommendation saying, let us re-examine this in 1 month or 2 months. People do what you attend to, not what you intend them to do. People do what you attend to, not what you intend them to do. And if you don't check it, they'll think it'll all go away. Next, never use humor in performance reviews, because people think you're making fun of them. Humor is fine in a lecture. Humor is necessary to keep you awake. You know, I'll be like a cross-eyed javelin thrower. I'll give you medals to try to keep you awake. As a lecturer, those of you in the academic world know it's important. It is important to have a sense of humor in politics, but not when you're doing the performance review. You know, laughter is an internal massage. You lose all tension when you laugh. Also breaks down the barrier between a lecturer and the students. You know, one woman told me she goes into jobs because she likes to hear heavy breathing again. Never at night, never on weekends, no more than one or two. Never with humor, it's too often misinterpreted as sarcasm. And finally, you end with hope. You end that I mean you no harm. If you ever analyze how you train animals, you'll notice that the first thing you gotta do is you gotta swim among the porpoises and demonstrate that you mean them no harm. If they think you're doing it to make yourself look better, or to get rid of your anger, you mean them no harm. All you want to do is to make certain that you are interested in their growth as an individual. Now, in order to be an effective executive, one must also... Can I have a few more minutes? I don't want to...
Please continue.
All right. I follow the golden rule. The guy with the gold establishes the rules, and Jim and I will continue. One of the critical variables in management is the ability to maintain emotional stamina. Just plain energy. You can be the smartest person in the world, but if you have no energy, well, you'll have very little joy in life, and you'll be drained. You know, we call this burnout. All of us are energy systems. You remember your amoeba in your high school biology days? When you poked it, its energy went out. You stimulated it. If you stimulate it too hard, the energy went inside and become a hard core. That is burnout. Burnout results in sleeplessness, loss of sex drive, increased drinking, increased use of drugs, primarily because they want energy and they can't get it, so they try to get it through some external stimulus. Why do you think cocaine is so popular? Because it's an immediate energy push. You get that smoking, that smelling, sniffing, you know. That's what people do it for. A mother wakes up her son and says, you have to go to school today. He says, I don't want to go to school. I have no energy. The students hate me. The faculty hates me. I hate them. He says, give me two good reasons why I should get up and go to school. Says one, you're 39 years old. Two, you're the principal. So how do you get stamina? I use what I call the caddy.
will just give you very rapidly, as I said, if you're interested, I'll be happy to ply you with the articles that will back up these concepts. First is CADDY is an acronym, C-A-D-D-Y. I'm going to put it on here, but I don't have the movable acetate. First is people who have high degrees of energy are good communicators. They have a good network of people. They learn how to relate to people and they make small talk easily. Now it is not easy to communicate, by the way, because people have different kinds of aspirations, different kinds of mood states. But people who communicate, who can have a sense of relating, have a higher energy level. We know, for example, that people in nursing homes who get letters and cards from grandparents or from their grandchildren live longer. Grandparents and grandchildren get along famously anyway because they have a common enemy. People who are in communication, who have a high degree of ability to talk and to relate, live longer, have a higher energy. So don't limit your activities. Be involved in tech and in your church, and the more, see, energy is the more you use up, the more you have. Amazing phenomenon. By preserving energy, you lose it. By using it, you gain more. Because you've learned how creatively to use that in an expressive way. Next is anger. Anger is, the Talmud says, if you become to seek revenge is to dig two graves. People who have low energy have enormous anger. By the way, it also creates coronary heart disease. It's almost as bad as cholesterol and smoking, because it narrows your coronary arteries. You get very, very angry and it narrows your arteries. Next is dreams. Dreams on interpreter like letters to yourself unopened. You have to dream every night, two or three good REM dreams. What a REM dream is, rapid eyelid motion. If you move their eyes and I wake you up and I said, what did you dream last night? You will tell me. Rapid eyelid motion. But it is a way to get rid of the garbage of the day. When you dream in crazy ways. Some of you say you never dream. That's not true. Everybody dreams. You dream in technicolor, you dream in black and white, but you don't remember the dream. Dreaming releases a lot of the anger, a lot of the fantasy life. Dreams remove the emotional overlay. Now what prevents dreams? Sleeping pills. You take sleeping pills, you will not dream. If you take, it knocks out the REM cycle. If you drink alcohol before going to bed, it will knock out your REM cycle. You should stop drinking 2 or 3 hours before. You should avoid heavy exercise before going to bed. Jogging, for example. Sex. I just mentioned it. unless it's very satisfying, you can knock out the REM cycle. Too much heat in the room. That's why you British are absolutely right. Cool off the room. Sleep much better. And if you have too heavy a heated room. And never take calls from the office after 8 or 9 o'clock. Get ready for bed. You take calls, it agitates you. Also, if you travel across the country, try to travel during the day if you can. Because of the circadian rhythms around the clock. Try to travel in the daytime. Try to stay awake in the same hours as your time zone.
Well, we asked an American Airlines pilot what effect, you know, going from New York to London was British Airlines, and we were doing the interview. We said, you know, when's the last time you had sexual contact? He said, 1945. My interviewer fell off the chair. He said, that's a long time ago. He said, not really, it's, 22. So, dreams, next is the line. If you don't have a sense of humor, if you can't laugh, bodily laugh, you're gonna have problems with energy. We know now that recovery from surgery is faster when people have a sense of humor. In hospitals, we now are putting a joke of the day on the tray. To laugh is to be healthy, to give you a sense of perspective. I try to collect little things that I pick up on my travels. In Norway, gynecologist at a sauna, say a specialist in women and other diseases. Another one was in Italy, in Rome, there was a sign in the tailor shop and the dry cleaning shop said, leave your clothes here and enjoy the rest of the day. and then another energy expenditure is sex. But we don't have time for that. But we can, if you want to, I'll give it after question period. And finally, beyond stamina is the ability to understand oneself. And that was mentioned again in the competencies. So all I'm doing is kind of hitchhiking on your previous speakers. Self-insight. It means that no man is the same, no man or woman is the right man for the organization at the same, all the time. You need different people at different times. Let's just look at Britain. The first census of Britain was done approximately 85 years ago, and that developed in the sociological classification of upper class. You remember that in your sociology class, upper middle, etc. Do you know what the definition of 85 years ago in Britain was of lower middle class? People who could not afford two servants. What a shocking thing compared. First of all, you know, servants today are like virgins. You can't find them. And who has servants today? Well, the managing diversity, this is an area that I've been very interested in. To managers of the future, you're going to have to learn how to manage knowledge workers. They're going to have self-insight into themselves so they do not stereotype people or things. For example, knowledge workers and workers with whom do not report to you and are long distances away from you. Mrs. Rubin pointed out the response to complaint. Some of you missed that. It's a very important point. Response to complaints. Kellogg, here in Manchester, president, told me when I was working with him this week, said to me that we have found in Kellogg's that when a complaint comes through, even if we make no response to it, we took a control group and experimental group. One we took 2 months to respond to, one we did in 1 week. And we were much more generous after 2 months than we were after 1 week. You know who was more unhappy? The one who got the response 2 months later. Because they said, you help, why did it take you so long? The ability to understand diversity and to understand that managers in the future are going to have to understand themselves and what are their stereotypes and prejudices. For example, Metropolitan Life. You know what Metropolitan Life does? The speed of claims is very critical. In an accident or in a hospital claim or something, what Metropolitan does in the United States is, every night when British Airlines goes over to Shannon Airport, they send over thousands of forms to Ireland. Ireland has a high level of education and a very high level of unemployment. So they get very bright workers. Filling out the forms, they have American stamps on the forms. The form is filled out on the next plane that night from Ireland, hits New York, just as the planes are going out all over the country. They've reduced their claim latency, the time between response, by close to five times faster than they were before they came up with this. So you have to keep your mind open. You cannot, you must be able in tech and in your own companies with these challenges to keep your mind constantly open. And that depends upon your ability to understand yourself. IQ, stamina, lack of arrogance, the ability to present performance reviews, a commitment to education, self-insight. These are some of the characteristics that I'd like you to think about. And finally, I'd like to end with two quotes. One from an American General Douglas MacArthur, another international writer, James Michener. MacArthur wrote a poem to his son in the dark days of the Philippines when he did not know whether he would return. He said, "Oh Lord, build me a son who'll be strong enough to know when he's very weak. And I pray, oh Lord, lead him not in the path of ease and comfort, but under the stress and spur of difficulty and challenge. Here, oh Lord, let him learn to stand up in the storm. Here, let him learn compassion for those who fail. And I pray, O Lord, teach him a sense of humor, that he may take things seriously, yet never himself seriously. And then I, his father, will dare to whisper that I have not lived in vain." Or better yet, James Mitch in his book, Fire is a Spring, when he said, "This is the journey we all must make to find ourselves. And it matters little else what you find in life. Love, money, power, status, many men or women. It'll all be thrown into the bin marked failure. But if a man or woman happens to find themselves, if they know what they can be counted upon to do, the limits of their courage, the extent of their dedication, their ability to surrender part of their inner life to some man or woman, then they have a mansion which they can occupy with dignity and with respect all the years of their lives." You have been marvelously attentive. And I really appreciate being here. It's a marvelous spot. And I worked with Jack Kennedy, and I know he had some problems, physical. When he said to Jacqueline, "You're one in a million," he meant it. He had a glandular problem, but he still had a marvelous charisma. And I remember once asking somebody who worked with him, and he said, "We didn't know we were in Camelot till it was all over." So thank you for bringing me to this Camelot conference. Thank you.